eKatra Podcast Conversations, for the curious essential knowledge, simplified. Your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of eKatra AI. Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we are taking, well, maybe not a scalpel, but certainly a close look at one of the world's most ancient and complex traditions.
That's right. We're using Kim Knott's fantastic book, Hinduism, a very short introduction, as our guide.
And our mission today really is to help recalibrate how you might think about this tradition. We want to move past those, you know, overly simplified, often monolithic stereotypes you hear in the West.
Exactly. Knott's argument, which we'll dig into, is that Hinduism isn't best understood as a single religion in the way we often think of it. It's more like a vast, incredibly complex, and constantly evolving family of traditions.
And getting a handle on this is, it's actually really relevant today, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. For basic cultural literacy, it's essential. Plus, understanding this diversity is crucial if you want to make sense of contemporary Indian politics, where the term Hindu gets used in very specific, often political ways.
And beyond India, it just offers a great way to think about diversity within any big category, you know, to look beyond the simple labels we stick on things.
So let's talk about our guide here, Kim Knott. Who is she?
Well, she's a distinguished British scholar, a professor of religious and secular studies at Lancaster University. And importantly, her background isn't just in ancient texts.
Right. Her specialty is more in the sociology of religion, and particularly the South Asian diaspora, so how these traditions live and breathe outside of India as well.
And that's what makes her perspective, I think, so valuable for this discussion. Her focus is very much on lived religion.
Yeah, she's not just concerned with, you know, the philosophical ideas from millennia ago, though those are important. She's really looking at how communities today, whether they're in India or the UK or the US, how they actually practice, adapt, and kind of embody their faith right now.
Mm-hmm. And that work on the diaspora, it gives her this global view, doesn't it? It's not purely India-centric. She sees how Hinduism is being, well, renegotiated and transformed across the world in real time.
And there's her approach, too. She calls it methodological empathy.
Okay, what does that mean in practice?
It means she really tries to understand Hindu concepts on their own terms, from the inside out, rather than forcing them into neat Western boxes.
Like trying to decide if it's strictly monotheism or polytheism.
Exactly. Those categories often just don't capture the complexity or the spiritual reality for practitioners. She avoids imposing those external lenses.
Okay, let's get to the core argument then, because you mentioned it earlier, and it feels like a really fundamental starting point.
Yeah.
Knott's big kind of provocative insight.
Yeah, it's that the very word Hinduism itself is actually a relatively modern external construct. It wasn't originally a religious term used by the people themselves in that way.
Wow. Okay, so where did it come from?
It started out essentially as a geographical label. It comes from the Persian word for the people living beyond the Indus River. It basically just meant the people over there.
Just descriptive geography, not theology.
Precisely.
So when did it change? When did it become this label for a single religion?
That happened much, much later. It was really solidified during the British colonial period. The British administration, you know, liked to categorize things.
Right, for administrative purposes, legal codes.
Exactly. They needed to define and codify what they were encountering, much like they understood Christianity or Islam as singular entities.
Yeah.
So they took that existing geographical term, Hindu, and essentially turned it into a noun representing a unified world religion.
That's fascinating. So an accident of geography and colonial bureaucracy kind of created the umbrella term we now use for this incredibly diverse family of traditions that didn't necessarily see itself as one single thing before that.
Largely, yes. Knott points out that even a term like Sanatana Dharma, which means something like the eternal way or eternal order, and is used by many Hindus today, that term gained widespread popularity relatively recently, often as a way to respond to those colonial definitions and critiques.
Okay, so the book structure makes sense that it has to start by unpacking the name itself.
Right. It starts there, then moves back in time to look at the foundational texts, the Vedas, the Upanishads, then it builds up, exploring core concepts, deities, practices, and finally brings us to modern realities like caste, nationalism, and the global diaspora.
It sounds like it gives you the tools to build a much more nuanced picture.
That's the goal.
Mm.
So shall we start with those texts? The architecture of scripture.
Let's do it. You mentioned two main categories.
Yes, Shruti and Smriti. Shruti literally means that which is heard. This is considered the most sacred layer, divinely revealed. Primarily, we're talking about the four Vedas Rig, Sama, Yajur, Atharva.
And their power isn't just the content, is it? It's also about the sound.
Very much so. Correct recitation, the sonic power of the mantras, is incredibly important. Historically, they were heavily focused on liturgical use, especially complex sacrificial rituals called yajna.
But then comes a big shift within the tradition itself, right, with the Upanishads?
Exactly. The Upanishads are later texts, sort of commentaries appended to the Vedas, and they mark this profound shift away from external ritual sacrifice towards internal philosophical inquiry.
And this is where we get those really big abstract concepts.
This is where they come to the fore. Concepts like Brahman, the ultimate, impersonal, underlying reality of everything, and Atman, the individual self, the soul.
That's such a huge intellectual leap. And the core insight is?
The core philosophical realization, the path to liberation or moksha, is understanding that your individual self, Atman, is ultimately identical to that ultimate reality, Brahman. It's not about pleasing gods through external sacrifice anymore. It's about this deep internal meditative realization.
It really shifts the focus inward, away from needing priests and elaborate rituals in the same way.
It does. It opens up a very different kind of spiritual path. Now, alongside this Shruti literature, you have Smriti.
Which means that which is remembered.
Correct. And this is a vast, much more accessible body of literature, hugely popular. This includes the great epics, the Ramayana and the Mahabharata. And the Mahabharata itself contains the Bhagavad Gita, which is incredibly influential.
In these stories, the Smriti, they play a crucial role, don't they? Because that Brahmanatman stuff can be pretty abstract.
Absolutely vital. The Smriti texts take those high-level philosophical concepts and translate them into compelling stories, into narratives about gods, heroes, and demons. They allow ordinary people to grapple with complex ideas like Dharma through the lives and struggles of these characters.
Let's pause on Dharma. You mentioned it. And Nat says it's probably the single most important concept, but also really hard to translate.
It is notoriously difficult. Because it's not just duty or law or religion or ethics, though it encompasses elements of all of those.
So what is it?
At its broadest, it's the underlying order, the inherent structure that sustains everything, the cosmos, society, the individual. It's the principle of rightness or appropriateness that keeps things in balance. Acting according to Dharma means aligning yourself with that cosmic pattern.
Okay, but if it's this universal cosmic law, how does that actually work day to day? My right action might be different from yours, right?
Okay.
How does one code fit everyone?
And that's where the nuance comes in, which Nat explains really well. There's the concept of Sanatana Dharma, the universal eternal order, but then there's Svadharma.
Sva meaning own.
Exactly. Svadharma is one's own specific contextual duty or path. It depends on your social position, your stage of life, your innate nature, your circumstances. So the right action for a warrior is different from the right action for a priest or a student.
So it's very contextual ethics in a way.
Very much so. And this idea of right action, Svadharma, is directly linked to karma.
The law of cause and effect.
Right. The law of action and consequence. Your actions, aligned or misaligned with your dharma, create consequences that shape your future experiences, potentially across many lifetimes. This drives the cycle of birth, death, and rebirth, which is called samsara.
And the ultimate goal is to get out of that cycle.
Yes. The ultimate aim is moksha, liberation from samsara altogether. Nat really paints a picture of this deeply interconnected moral universe where individual actions ripple outwards.
Okay, so we have these deep texts, these core concepts of cosmic order and consequence. What about the gods? The pantheon, because that's often the first image people have, right? Lots of gods.
It is. And the common Western label polytheism really oversimplifies things, as Nat points out. It misses the layered nature of how the divine is understood.
Layered? How so?
Well, these different ways of perceiving the divine can often coexist quite comfortably. The divine might be understood as that single impersonal ultimate reality, Brahman, or it might be experienced as a single personal god, often called Ishvara. Or it can manifest as a multiplicity of gods and goddesses, the devas and devas.
So it's not necessarily seen as a contradiction to hold these different views?
Not necessarily. It's often seen as different levels of understanding or different ways the ultimate reality makes itself accessible to humans. The diversity implies comprehensiveness, not contradiction.
Okay. And within that multiplicity, there's some major figures or groupings.
Yes, you have major devotional traditions centered around key deities. There's the concept of the Trimurti, often translated as Trinity, though that's a bit misleading. It includes Brahma, the creator figure, Vishnu, the preserver, and Shiva, the destroyer and regenerator.
And Vishnu has those famous descents, the avatars.
Correct. The concept of the avatar is huge. Vishnu is believed to descend to Earth in various forms, famously as Rama in the Ramayana, and Krishna in the Mahabharata whenever Dharma is in decline to sort of restore balance.
But Nat emphasizes something else too, doesn't she? About the goddess.
Yes, absolutely. She stresses the centrality of the goddess, known by many names like Devi or Shakti, meaning power. The divine feminine is worshipped not just as a consort to male gods, but very importantly, as the supreme, independent deity in her own right in many traditions. She's seen as the ultimate source of all cosmic energy and power.
So a really complex picture of the divine. Now, how do people actually interact with all this? We have philosophy, epics, gods. Where does the everyday person connect?
And that brings us squarely back to Nat's focus on lived practice. For a great many Hindus, the real heart of their religious life isn't necessarily studying the Upanishads.
It's more about the doing.
Exactly. It's about sensory devotional acts. Things like puja, the ritual offerings made to deities, whether at home or in a temple. This can involve flowers, incense, food, light.
And crucially, darshan.
Yes, darshan. This is such a key concept. It's the act of seeing the deity's image, or murti, and importantly, being seen by the deity. It's understood as a direct reciprocal exchange, a moment of connection and blessing. For many, that immediate visual reciprocal experience is far more central than abstract textual study.
That makes sense. It's a very different way of relating to the divine than just reading about it.
Definitely. And this focus on practice and community leads us, inevitably, to the social structure, the caste system.
Which is incredibly complex and often misunderstood. Not make some careful distinctions here, right?
Yes, and it's really important to grasp them.
Yeah.
First, there's the theoretical model, the Varna system. This is the ancient fourfold classification you often read about. Brahmins, priests, scholars, kshatriyas, warriors, rulers, vaishyas, merchants, farmers, and shudras, laborers, service providers.
Okay, that's the theory. But then there's jati.
Exactly. And this is the crucial distinction for understanding the lived reality. Jati refers to the thousands of localized, hereditary, often occupation-based, endogamous communities, meaning people traditionally marry within their jati. Jati is the functional system that has historically governed daily life, social interaction, and marriage rules on the ground.
So the four varnas are like broad categories, but the jatis are the actual specific groups people belong to by birth.
That's a good way to put it. And not as clear, this system isn't just theoretical. It has historically involved hierarchy and, very significantly, discrimination, particularly against those communities considered outside or below the Varna system, traditionally referred to as Dalits or untouchables.
It's obviously a deeply contested and complex system, but not shows how it's historically been intertwined with the religious worldview itself.
Yes, ideas about purity, occupation, and inherited duty have been deeply embedded within the framework, though it's hugely debated and challenged today.
Which brings us to the modern era. How has this ancient family of traditions navigated colonialism and modernity?
Well, Nat shows that colonialism itself acted as a catalyst for change. It spurred various reform movements in the 19th century, like the Brahmo Samaj, led by figures like Ram Mohan Roy. They often tried to rationalize aspects of the tradition, sometimes emphasizing monotheism, partly in response to Christian missionary critiques.
But perhaps the most significant development in the modern era, especially politically, is the rise of Hindu nationalism, or Hindutva.
This is absolutely essential to understand, particularly if you follow contemporary Indian politics. Nat explains that Hindutva, articulated early on by figures like V.D. Sabarkar, is fundamentally a political ideology.
Okay, so not synonymous with the religious faith itself.
That's the critical distinction Nat makes. Hindutva seeks to define Indian national identity primarily in Hindu cultural, historical, and territorial terms. It aims to unite Hindus politically. While it draws on religious symbols and history, its core aim is political mobilization and defining the nation.
That distinction between the broad, diverse faith traditions and this specific political ideology is crucial, but probably often blurred in media coverage.
Very often blurred, not really underscores the importance of keeping them distinct. And this whole complex picture isn't static, especially with globalization.
Right. You mentioned her work on the diaspora.
Yes. She looks at how communities in places like London or Houston or Toronto are actively adapting rituals, building new kinds of community centers and temples, and forging these dynamic, sometimes new, localized Hindu identities far from India. It shows the tradition is alive, adapting, changing.
So pulling back a bit, what are the big themes, the core messages not wants us to take away from this very short introduction?
I think there are three really powerful ones. The first is just how inadequate our standard Western religious categories often are.
Like we discussed with monotheism and polytheism.
Exactly. But also the basic separation we often make between the sacred and the secular. In many Hindu worldviews, that strict line doesn't really exist in the same way. Concepts like dharma weave together cosmic order, social duty, personal ethics. Potentially all aspects of life can have spiritual significance.
And reflecting on that, it really forces you to question those neat boxes we put things in, right? Why assume faith has to be separate from ethics or daily life?
Precisely. The second big theme is how unity is achieved in this tradition. It's not through demanding everyone believe the exact same thing.
It's not about uniform belief or a single church structure.
No. Instead, unity comes from a set of shared core concepts, dharma, karma, samsara, moksha, and a shared cosmological framework. This underlying vocabulary allows for this incredible diversity of sects, philosophies, and regional practices to flourish underneath.
It's a fascinating model, isn't it? A tradition held together by maybe shared concerns and ongoing debate rather than mandated beliefs.
It really is. And the third theme flowing from that is the sheer adaptability and historical evolution of it all.
It's not stuck in the past.
Not at all. Not shows it as constantly evolving from the focus on Vedic sacrifice, shifting to Upanishadic philosophy, then the rise of devotional bhakti movements, and now navigating colonialism, nationalism, and globalization. It's resilient and fluid.
It really drives home that any tradition that lasts for millennia has to be capable of change, internal critique, and renewal. It's a living thing, not some kind of museum piece.
Perfectly put.
The book must have some really memorable lines that capture these ideas. Can we paraphrase a few key takeaways?
Definitely. One that sums up the central thesis would be something like, "To search for a single definition of Hinduism is to embark on a misguided quest. It's better understood as a family of traditions, a dynamic mix of diverse beliefs and practices."
That really sets the stage, challenges you to embrace the complexity from the start.
Another one, highlighting the importance of dharma, might be, "Dharma isn't just simple duty or law, it's the fundamental principle maintaining cosmic and social order, while also guiding individual moral growth."
It stresses that layered meaning we talked about, not just a single word translation.
And focusing on lived experience, something like, "For many Hindus, the reciprocal gaze exchanged with a deity's image and a darshan is often a more profound and immediate experience of the divine than studying abstract philosophy."
That really hits home. Knott's focus on practice, reminding us that the believer's experience might prioritize ritual and connection over just intellectual understanding.
And one more, capturing the diaspora's dynamism. "A Hindu temple in London or Houston isn't just a copy of one in India. It's a new social and cultural space where traditions get renegotiated, rituals adapt, and a global Hindu identity is actively being forged."
Yeah, that emphasizes the ongoing living nature of tradition. It's not diluted by distance, it's reshaped.
So thinking about real life applications, how can listeners use these insights?
Well, one way is to use Knott's method itself as a kind of critical thinking model.
Mm-hmm.
Remember how she questions the very category Hinduism?
Mm-hmm.
Apply that same skepticism to other big, simple labels you run into, whether it's socialism, capitalism, conservatism, millennials, whatever. Ask yourself, what diversity, what complexity, what lived realities are being hidden or flattened by this single term?
That's a great takeaway. Look behind the label for the actual variety.
Another application could be reflecting on the ethical idea of Svadharma, that contextual duty.
Okay, how so?
Well, instead of always searching for one-size-fits-all universal moral rules, maybe consider your own ethical conduct in light of your specific roles and circumstances right now. Are you acting rightly as a parent, as a colleague, as a citizen, given your unique situation? It pushes towards a more nuanced situational ethics.
That encourages more thoughtful decision-making rather than just applying a rule book. I like that. And of course, the most direct application is simply enhanced cultural literacy.
Yeah, understanding these nuances helps dismantle stereotypes and allows for more respectful, informed engagement, whether you're traveling, working with diverse colleagues, or just understanding world news.
Definitely. So as we wrap up, any final thoughts, a favorite insight, or something that surprised you from Knott's approach?
For me, I think it was that deep philosophical core, the Upanishadic idea of Atman equals Brahman. Realizing that this profound, almost mystical, internal goal of realizing oneness exists right alongside the incredible richness and multiplicity of the gods and rituals, it just shows such an amazing depth and breadth within the tradition that coexistence is really striking.
Yeah. For me, the lasting lesson is that forced paradigm shift not encourages. Moving away from thinking of Hinduism as a single solid noun and starting to see Hindu more as an adjective describing this vast, diverse, evolving, sometimes contested family of traditions and ways of life, understanding that complexity, embracing it, feels like the real key to genuine literacy about it.
A really important shift in perspective.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akhotra Foundation.